Good day and welcome to today's Prevention Connection web conference. Today's conference is being recorded. At this time, I would like to turn the conference over to Mr. David Lee. Please go ahead, sir.
Thank you very much and welcome to the Prevention Connection web conference, Engaging Bystanders in Violence Against Women Prevention. I'm very excited to see so many of you from around the country here today for our web conference. Prevention Connection is a project of the California Coalition Against Sexual Assault. And on the screen here, we do have information about how to contact us, and that myself and Chad Sniffen, who is on the call also, are your main contacts, and feel free to contact us if you have any questions. Prevention Connection can be found at our website, www.preventconnect.org, and I just want to alert you to the many different services that we have available on our website. Our website has our podcasts, our online presentations that are brief summaries of our Prevention Connection web conferences, and our Prevent Connect Wiki. The Prevent Connect Wiki is an exciting project, which is a user-generated website to develop the knowledge base of people who do primary prevention of violence against women to be able to add their own information about how they do the work and capture the evidence of practice that exists in the field. This will include a lot of information coming from people in the field, so I encourage you to go visit our wiki to be able to get information. In addition, you can sign up for our Prevent Connect listserv. We have over 900 people interested in prevention of violence against women and have a lively discussion as a listserv. We also have, of course, you signed up for our web conferences, and we have what we call our reading clubs. And our reading clubs is we take recent articles and have a very small group of people have a discussion about the article with other people around the country so they can be able to share information. So we're real excited to do this. We will be having, as an upcoming article, more articles about bystanders and some new work that's been put out by Alan Berkowitz. I expect we will actually be opening that up very soon. Please join us on Facebook. That Prevent Connect is now on Facebook. We want to be able to build that connection of people who are doing prevention and use our social networking sites for social good. Also, you will find archives of information of our previous web conferences and materials on our website. Today's web conference has a lot of really valuable information, so I encourage you to visit us at preventconnect.org. Our next web conference will be on September 18th, and this will be led by, it's on culture and violence against women, exploring rap and other popular music genres, and to be able to look at that and how we can be able to do violence against women prevention. And this will be led by the Prevention Institute, so it should be a very interesting workshop. Registration will be opening soon, and please sign up quickly. As you know, our web conferences fill very quickly. I want to highlight a few pieces about how to be able to use our technology, because there's some many great sources that we can be able to do. On the left-hand side, you see a bar that looks like the bar on the screen. My picture appears there now. That will be the picture of whoever is speaking that's in there, and that's something that we can be able to do. One feature that we can do is the raised hand feature, and this raised hand feature is above my picture, I'll circle what it looks like here. If everyone can please raise your hand, do that. And that would be a great way for us just to get a sense of who is in the meeting. So far I've seen 24, 33, 36 of you, 45 of you have raised your hand. So keep on raising your hand. We might be asking questions during our presentation and ask you to raise hands to be able to get information. I see that 64 of you have raised your hand. Someone's putting their hand down, and so please raise your hand. Also, when we want to have questions and answers, please raise your hand, and what we will do then is we will, when we have our question and answer period, we will open up the phone line there. I'm going to go ahead and lower all the hands now so I can do that from my end. So that should be happening, though it didn't seem to quite yet. So there, it is down. We also have a question and answer and place where we can be able to ask questions from people in the audience. And so what I'd like to do is be able to ask a little few questions about those of you in the audience so we can learn about who you are in the audience. Many of you have been writing in where you're from, and it's great to see how many people are where people are from. I'm now going to ask the first question, which is, have you attended previous Prevention Connection web conference? And you should see this appearing on your screen soon. The question, though, and go ahead, and I know that you see yes, you have attended a previous one, or no, you haven't. And go ahead and please vote. That's appearing on your screen. You can click either the dot next to yes or no, and we can see who's in there. I see a few people are putting it in the text chat, because I know that you have more than one person, and one person can't see anything. You should look on the top. There might be a tab that says Bystander QA, and I see that many of you are voting, and now that person says they can see it. And so sometimes it takes a little longer to appear on your screen, depending on your web connection. I'll just share some of the results, because some of you have not answered the question yet, but it is useful to know that we have 50% have attended a previous Prevention Connection web conference, and 24% is your first time, and the other 26% of you, I guess, chose not to vote. So we will now withdraw that question and ask the second question. Get a sense of who is your, what is your organization, and describe what your organization is like. So I'm going to ask that question. So I'm giving a funny response on my command, so I am asking the question now. So the question should be appearing. And it's, what best describes your organization? Are you a domestic violence agency? Are you a sexual assault agency? Are you with a public health department, whether local, statewide, or national? Are you with education, a college or a university? Or if you are other, and I see some people writing in their others. I see some state health departments, quite a few state health departments. I see someone saying hi to someone else there. Some dual agencies from state coalitions. And I see that people are voting in here, and some ones from a county hospital. I'm going to share the results with you just so you can get a sense of who is in the audience. And that we have about 14% from domestic violence agencies, 18% from sexual assault agencies, 9% from public health, 17% from education, college, or university. Welcome to have you, and 11% other. And many people are writing in what they are, and so I'd like to thank you that. I'm going to go ahead and close that window. So we will close that for everyone and now go back to this. The text chat's the other feature that many of you are now seeing how to do. The text chat is a way that in Prevention Connection we have a robust discussion beyond the discussion you'll be hearing and seeing, and it's a great opportunity to know who is else doing work around the country. I do encourage you that the text chat is very hard to read when there's a lot of people writing. You can expand your box. It's called undocking it. There's a circle. I'm circling this, the box in the far right-hand, top right-hand corner. If you do that, it will open up the box and make it easier to read the text chats. So we will hear the text chats. We will be saving a copy of them, and we will post them on the website. We will take away the names and we'll generally keep this here. I'm going to take out the high information, but keep the content of discussion so people can get a sense of who of the discussion, and people will be sharing resources within the web conference, so that's something we want to do. We also have PowerPoint slides that you're seeing on the screen. These PowerPoint slides are available on our website at www.preventconnect.org, so you can get the information there. If you have any problem with the technology, you can send us a private text chat by just clicking on my name, or you expand, you know, you can do private. You can press the chat. You have to expand the piece, and you can click on David Lee or Leaders and Assistants and send me a private chat. Or you can call Eiling Technical Assistance at 800-799-4510. Or you can call CalCASA at 888-922-5227. In Prevention Connection, we talk about, we use the term violence against women. What we mean by violence against women is that we are looking at domestic violence and sexual violence. And we are looking at it in a very broad way. We are looking at violence across the lifespan for all ages. And we are also looking to prevent before violence starts. And we're looking to make connections to other forms of violence and other related issues. Prevention Connection works with many other national resource centers that have been funded by the Centers for Disease Control to do prevention, to provide information. We encourage you to visit these websites, the National Sexual Violence Resource Center, the National Youth Violence Prevention Resource Center, and VolNet, the National Online Resource Center on Violence Against Women. Prevention Connection is sponsored by the U.S. Centers for Disease Control and Prevention. The views and information provided in this web conference do not necessarily represent the official views of the United States government, the CDC, or CASA, the California Coalition Against Sexual Assault. So that is the famous disclaimer. So I am really pleased to be able to be here today for our conference and have some really exciting speakers from some leading organizations that are doing the work around bystander prevention, using the bystander approach to be able to do prevention of violence against women. So we have as our speakers here today from the National Sexual Violence Resource Center, Karen Baker. Welcome, Karen.
Hi, everybody. Thank you.
And we also have from the University of New Hampshire, Vicki Baynard. Hi, Vicki.
Hi, everyone. It's such a pleasure to be here today.
Great. And we have from right now, I think you're down in Florida today, Jeff O'Brien from Mentors in Violence Prevention.
Hi, David. Hi, everybody. It's great to be here with you.
Great. Well, it's great to have all of you, and we've had a really great time in having our discussions together on how in putting together this web conference. The bystander approach, I think, is a very important approach for us to be able to use in understanding this. In Prevention Connection, as I said, we talk about primary prevention, and this is a definition from Prevention Institute. This is the definition of it's a systematic process that promotes healthy environments and behaviors and reduces the likelihood or frequency of violence against women. It's about taking action before violence against women takes place. And so what we want to do is look at bystander as a way to be able to toward primary prevention. Our learning objectives for today is for you to be able to describe the bystander approach for primary prevention of violence against women, identify some resources that you can use, and also be able to describe the key elements of two leading bystander prevention programs, which we'll be talking about today. So the when we talk about violence against women prevention, in some ways there's three different ways that one can think about this. One is that we can work on preventing victimization. And that preventing victimization is something that I think our movement, the Violence Against Women movement, has put a lot of work in trying to prevent people from being victims. There are some cautions that we have to be attentive to, that there could be inadvertent victim blaming that can be done in this, and that this is important work and valuable work, but only one piece of the work. Another focus is on trying to prevent perpetration and trying to identify those who could be perpetrating and preventing them from doing that and focusing on the work that they do. There's certainly quite a bit of work in secondary and tertiary prevention around working with people who have already been have committed violence against women, and then we also think about that from a prevention end. But the other piece about violence against women prevention is how do we change the environmental conditions that create perpetration and victimization? And in this, we have to be able to look at the issues of social norms, to be able to look at policies, organizational practices, and how we live the types of organizations and settings we live in. And another approach is to be engaging bystanders to be able to take action. It's an approach that's very different than working with treating everyone as either potential victims or potential perpetrators. Instead, it's about engaging everyone as potential bystanders. So to talk about this, we've brought together three fabulous panelists who will be able to talk about that. So we'll start with this introduction, talk about the bystander approach. Vicki will then talk about bringing the bystander. Jeff will talk about mentors and violence prevention, and then we will have a discussion. And so, and I see we're already having a discussion about working with Byron Hurt. We'll come out hip-hop next month, so Let's come there. So I'd like to welcome Karen Baker from the National Sexual Violence Resource Center, who can be talking about an exciting new publication that's going to be coming out. So, Karen, can you tell us about what's going to be coming out? The National Sexual Violence Resource Center is releasing next month.
Yes. Thank you for allowing me to participate today. I find this topic a really interesting one. And the NSVRC is pleased to soon be publishing a document called Engaging Bystanders in Sexual Violence Prevention, written by Joan Tabachnik. And Joan is sorry that she's not able to be here today. And I was hoping to have this this document for you today, but we want Joan to be able to take one more look at it when she returns from her vacation. So we will have this available in about 2 weeks, and then we will have the printed version about 3 weeks after that.
Right, and for all of you, we will, if you want to order forms, order copies of this, we do have on the Prevent Connect website a link to be able to order forms, and we will also, once it's released, send this to all of you, letting you know when this will be released. So, Karen, can you talk about, in this publication, what are some of the features that you'll be having?
Yes. Well, this guide gives a description and a history of bystander intervention and provides some context for that, specifically in relation to preventing sexual violence. And it offers examples of a wide range of actions that people could consider depending upon the situation they find themselves in. And I think an especially important feature of the booklet is several skill-building activities that Joan has provided for us to use with different size groups, because we know that knowledge alone is not enough to change behaviors. It takes practice to really get comfortable with doing some of these things. And then, of course, it also includes a bibliography of additional resources where people can go for more information, including the two excellent programs that we're going to learn about today.
Great. Why don't you talk about what you mean by bystander, the term bystander?
Yes. I want to talk about the term separately from the content just for a minute, but I think the term bystander can actually be a bit problematic for us, and ironically is problematic in two opposite directions. First of all, the term is sometimes used in a very passive sense. For instance, how many of you have heard someone say something like, get involved, don't be a bystander? And that, of course, implies that bystanders are just witnesses who stand around and watch something and do nothing. And that's not what we mean by bystander intervention. So this guide uses adjectives like active bystander or responsible bystander to help clarify what we mean by the term. And then the term bystander can also be problematic at the opposite end of the spectrum, particularly when you're thinking about preventing sexual violence, because some people then worry that they're being asked to physically jump into a dangerous situation, which could be a really scary thing to do. And that's not what we mean either. So this guide offers a wide range of possible actions that bystanders can safely do to interrupt situations early before they become extremely dangerous. And I think early intervention is really the key here.
Right, I see that Bethany wrote in that they suggested using a term ally, and so that might be something that we can be able
to. Yeah, I think that's a good suggestion. I'm hoping to see some discussion here today about the word and whether or not we should use this one or think about something else. But in spite of the word itself, you know, being a bit problematic, I think the concept is an extremely exciting and hopeful one. And so I'm glad that we're talking about that here today.
Karen, can you talk about what you see some of the benefits are of using a bystander approach?
Absolutely. Well, first of all, and I think you already alluded to this, David, but the term bystander allows everyone an opportunity to get involved with this work of preventing sexual violence. Certainly not everyone is comfortable identifying themselves as a survivor or as a potential victim, or definitely not as a perpetrator. But we can all be, and in fact we all are, bystanders daily to various situations. It's a neutral term, and there's absolutely no stigma in being a bystander. And because of its neutrality, it also discourages victim blaming, which so often happens when we're talking about situations, even when we don't intend to do that. So instead of asking, for instance, well, why was she there? What was she doing? We can now ask, what could we have done to intervene? And just by changing that question, what could we have done, it shifts the whole focus of the conversation, and it shifts the responsibility for prevention. And that's, I think, a really exciting concept. And it also then provides us with many opportunities to begin to challenge and change those social norms that have allowed bullying, harassment, and violence to continue.
You also talked about in there the continuum of behaviors. And this is a concept that I've noticed that all three of you have that's an important part. So can you talk about that?
Yes. Obviously, there are a lot of different behaviors that people can engage in or can observe, you know, in a given day. And this, actually, if we start over on the right side and work right to left, it goes from healthy interactions or relationships over, you know, to very dangerous one with lots of points in between. And so this booklet encourages us to pay careful attention to situations and try to think about where they might fall on a continuum such as this. So if you're observing something happening in the grocery store or at work, you might just pay close attention and ask yourself, you know, is it a healthy interaction? Is it playful? Is it mutual? Or is it beginning to cross the line and make you a bit uncomfortable, getting perhaps into a gray area that may not be age appropriate or may not be completely consensual? Or is it clearly out of line and in the area of harassment or sexual abuse? And, of course, each of those places on the continuum has different opportunities or ramifications for actions that we might take. And we don't always just have to be focusing on negative behavior and interrupting that. I think an important role for bystander intervention is to reinforce positive behaviors that we see. You know, if we see someone asking permission to get a hug, for instance, I think we should reinforce that behavior. I think that's just as important in shaping our cultural norms.
Absolutely. In order for someone to be able to take a bystander action, it's not something you just do automatically. What are some of the steps that you see, Karen?
Right. I think it's interesting that researchers have broken this down into very discrete steps. And basically, for someone to intervene in a situation, five things have to happen. Of course, they happen very quickly. But when you break it down, first of all, I must observe or notice the interaction. And then I must consider whether or not the situation requires any action. And if so, is it my responsibility to act? I think this is a really important step, and a lot of the work in our bystander intervention field, I think, is designed to encourage people to become more comfortable getting involved. Fourth, if I do decide to accept the responsibility, then I need to consider all my options and select the best one given the information that I have, the resources that I have available, and the dynamics of the situation. And after all of that has filtered through my brain and I finally choose a course of action, well, then I need to have the knowledge, the skills, the confidence to do it, to implement the action. And this is where that practice will come in handy.
Right. I think another piece is that we also need to think about our community and how we support the people taking those bystander responses, and it's not just about individuals doing it, but it's really a community response, and that people are more likely to engage in active bystander roles if indeed we have a community where those says that is the acceptable behavior to be doing.
Absolutely.
And so thank you, Karen, so much for doing this. I'm real excited and looking forward for your new publication to be coming out. And when we talk about community response, we're going to be turning next to Vicki Manyard from the University of New Hampshire, who's going to be, brought Karen right back on there. So, Vicki, who will be talking about the Bringing in the Bystander program over at the University of New Hampshire. So, hello, Vicki.
Hello, David, and everyone. Thank you so much again. I really appreciate being asked to be on the web conference today and share a little bit about the work that we've been doing in New Hampshire and hopefully add to the conversation. So our program is called Bringing in the Bystander. We have been doing it for a number of years here at UNH. I'm going to just share a little bit with folks about what we do, highlighting in particular that our work really builds on a lot of really important programs and founding work that came before us. And you're going to actually hear from Jeff O'Brien and the MVP program a little bit later today. And they definitely are one of the first to really have developed and looked into this. And so I'll be sharing a little bit about what we're doing and then particularly talking about a focus that we have, which is on evaluation and some exciting findings, showing, I think, that there's some reason to be optimistic about this this perspective on prevention.
So why don't you talk about your guiding principles?
And I think these really come from a lot of the things that Karen was saying, and they're going to fit with what Jeff is going to be talking about later. But I think, for me, one of the things that's really exciting about a bystander approach is that there are so many different pathways, both from research literature and also from different theories of health behavior change and working to prevent violence against women that all kind of lead to the same clearing in the woods, which is this bystander approach. And I think that it's also sort of supportive for what we're doing. But definitely we're using, I think, a bystander approach is rooted in our understanding of ecological models of the causes of violence, the idea that peer norms, social norms, a community response, whether that response is to do nothing or to look away or to be actively engaged, can make a really big difference in terms of the incidence and prevalence of this problem. And so I think that's where, you know, the interest comes in mobilizing bystanders. Yeah, on the next slide, we have a lot of theoretical models. Again, like Karen was saying, the idea that we want to be changing attitudes and behaviors, but that I think the two are linked in some important ways. Some work that we've been doing that's sort of beyond the scope of what we're talking about today, but if people are interested, some recent work that we're trying to do in our research is looking at how different groups may need different facets of the program, so really looking at a readiness to change model and kind of tweaking the program in that way. And so people can feel free to get in touch with me if they want to talk more about that stuff. But definitely grounding our work a lot in the social psychology of bystander intervention. And I think Karen did a really nice job of kind of summarizing those main action steps. And I think what you'll see as I go on next to kind of talking about some of the specifics of what we're doing on our campus, you'll see that what we do kind of follows directly from those action steps. And no, UNH doesn't look like that yet, but soon. It's still actually beautiful and 70 here, but it'll probably be snowing by next week. I saw on the call somebody from Vermont was saying you all are supposed to get frost tonight. I don't think we're getting frost yet, but you get it a little sooner than we do. So bringing in the bystander at UNH includes a number of different components. We do have an in-person kind of educational workshop, both short versions and long versions of that. My colleagues, Dr. Sharon Potter and other colleagues here at UNH, have also developed a Bringing in the Bystander social marketing campaign that raises awareness and does a lot of really important things, and I'll share just a little bit about their work. I can't take any credit. They've done all the work on that. We have done the program and the social marketing campaign with lots of different audiences, including staff members, student leaders, as well as kind of general student audiences, first-year students, that kind of thing. And then I think a real hallmark of what we're trying to do at UNH is evaluation and research. And we were fortunate enough a number of years ago to get a National Institute of Justice grant. We actually now have just gotten funding from the Centers for Disease Control and Prevention to continue evaluating this model. I'll talk a little bit about that in just a minute.
I'm very excited about that because Prevention Connection will keep people updated as what's going on in that evaluation, as we need so much of that to advance the work we're doing. So let's talk about the program and what do you actually do in your program at Bringing the Bystander.
Sure. I'll just give a few examples. And again, I think David will talk in a little bit about how folks can get a hold of the work that we do, both articles that have been written about the research that we do and also to get a better look at the curriculum. But As I said before, it's definitely founded on work by folks who really got this whole momentum started in the field, including Jackson Katz and folks at the MVP program like Jeff O'Brien, who you're going to hear from later today, Alan Berkowitz. We also try to draw from the sort of more general prevention practices about active learning exercises and skill building, single-sex groups, though we also have done some mixed-gender groups, and using community-specific stories. So a lot of what we do is sort of tell stories that are very pertinent and from our own community.
Great. And you do have the Bringing in the Bystander curriculum, and I'm really pleased that your willingness to share this curriculum, and that will be available to all the participants of this web conference. And we just, there's a few pieces that they're asking for people to acknowledge use of, you know, the sources from the curriculum and also people that they cite in the curriculum and also agree to be contacted on how they're using the curriculum. So at preventconnect.org, there is a questionnaire that you can fill out and then you can be able to download the curriculum and also some PowerPoint slides to help you do it. So what are the pieces of the Bringing in the Bystander program?
Again, the pieces of the program, we really try to map onto the action steps, what we know makes it more likely that people will step in. So we do a lot of work around exploring with participants their ideas of what a bystander is to kind of raise awareness about that, helping them identify risky situations because, again, we know, and as Karen was saying, getting people to understand that something may not be going wrong. Something may be going on, getting people to pay attention to that kind of feeling in your gut that's telling you that maybe something isn't quite right here. A lot of what we stress in the work that we do is helping people develop a range of interventions, but a range of safe interventions. So people always considering their own personal safety and the safety of those around them when they're making decisions about how to act. And then our program also includes a pledge to intervene, which I'll show an example of in a little bit, which, again, is meant to try to heighten people's sense of responsibility about engaging as active and responsible bystanders. So it's kind of an overall framework for what we're trying to do in either the sort of short or long version of the program. And then the next slide just kind of talks about some of those exercises.
Why don't you just, without going through this in detail, speak clearly. You go in and out of your phone, so try to stay close to the speaker, and talk a little bit about what the small group exercise does as an example.
Sure. We do a lot of small group work as part of the workshop. One example from early on in the program asks people to really explore times that they have observed someone intervening or not intervening on behalf of someone else, or times when they have chosen to intervene or not intervene. And we really keep it very broad at this particular point. So it doesn't have to be specific to sexual violence, but it can just be about where have they seen people in their community trying to help others or not trying to help others, and how, what are some of the factors that may play into people's decision, and the kinds of feelings and thoughts and all of those kinds of things that play into that. So that's an example of sort of the awareness building about what is a bystander.
Well, you talk about this slide here.
This is a part that would sort of come in the middle of the program, which, again, as Karen was talking about, helping increase people's awareness by helping them see that that there's really a continuum of behaviors that we're talking about. So we're trying to heighten participants' awareness of a full range of things that could be happening around them and trying to get them to have a lower threshold of noticing these kinds of things. So we have a number of activities that we do with participants built around getting them to see the scope of sexual violence across the continuum.
Victim empathy exercise. Describe that, please.
Yep. We also know from the research that people are more likely to intervene to the extent that they see themselves as similar to the person who needs help, to the person that they may be intervening on behalf of. And so we do an empathy building exercise again, the details are in the curriculum, but it's based around, tools that are fairly common in the prevention field around having people write down an important person, an important place, those kinds of things, and then gradually they have to rip those things up because as would happen for a survivor who's been assaulted by someone close to them or not believed by someone close to them, those social supports and safe places begin to go away in the aftermath of the assault. So that kind of thing to really put people in the position of someone who is a survivor to try to get them to appreciate that standpoint. What you also see on the slide is just a preview of that's one of the social marketing campaign posters that my colleagues have developed. The tagline for the campaign is know your power, step in, speak up, and this is what we call our empathy poster. So you see three different scenes of a survivor being comforted and being willing to come forward to a friend to say that they had been assaulted, and so kind of modeling that. The latter part of the program then really focuses on stepping in and taking action. A piece of that is making explicit the decision-making process. We also know that the decision to take action is not an easy one. Karen already talked about, and Jeff will talk more about, both the pros and cons of stepping in a particular situation. And I think the research is very clear that people do go through that weighing of pros and cons. And what we try to do is give people the opportunity to think through some of those things before they get in the heat of the moment, before they get in that situation. Because trying to go through that complicated decision process, if you haven't practiced it before, can be very difficult when you're there in the moment. So we model for participants asking questions like, am I aware there's a problem? Do I recognize someone needs help? Do I see myself as part of the solution? But then also asking very important things about how can I keep myself safe? What are my options? Are there others I can reach out to for help? What are the benefits and the costs? Those kinds of things. So we work really hard to get people to think through that in the course of the workshop. Next slide, actually.
People are asking where they can get the posters.
In a minute, we'll show you all that information.
We'll show you now, but I'm giving a little preview for people.
Yep.
So here.
Thank you. Excellent. So the other thing that we do, again, because bystander safety is important to us, is we also kind of give a little visual. I can't say I came up with this. I'm not a very good visual learner, but I do like this graphic. It helps people think about, again, because we're not trying to say there's one action you should always take, and if you can just learn how to do this, you'll be fine. We want people to have a broad range of tools and options. And then as part of their decision-making, we want them to think about, for any option, is it more or less safe for you? And so we use this grid to sort of show that to the extent that you have to intervene by yourself versus with others, to the extent that you need to intervene in the moment, up close versus at another time or more distant, say by using the phone instead of talking to someone in their face, that will lead you to be sort of in that upper left quadrant where things are least safe when you're intervening close up and intervening alone, to options that are most safe when you're able to intervene with others and intervene at more of a distance. And so, again, trying to get people to think about what is your toolkit and do you have things, obviously, sometimes in some situations you have no choice, you're alone, you have to think if you're going to step in, but to try to model kind of having a range of options there. So that's a kind of thing that we get people to think through. All of our participants leave with what we call the ABCs of intervention. It's actually a four-sided, very small. It's the size of a business card, but it folds out. This is the front of it, which is sort of a play on the ABCs, but also on the Red Cross little card that they have with some safety information for people who are trained as first responders. And this includes for our community members phone numbers, say at the crisis center, of the police, those kinds of things to remind remind people. It also inside has that decision tree that I showed you earlier, so it has it right there to remind people of that decision process, and it also includes some examples of things they might do to intervene, and so we give that to everyone as just kind of a cue, a reminder to kind of say, you know, keep thinking about this stuff, and maybe this would help you. Finally, we conclude our program with a bystander pledge, and this is where we actually ask participants to read through this and to sign it and take it with them and have someone else in the program witness it. And it's really designed to kind of up that level of felt responsibility. One of the things that early research in the 60s and 70s about bystanders suggested is that to the extent that people are asked to intervene, they're more likely to do so. And so we see this as a way. We also will look around the room when we do the program, and we'll say, okay, consider all of you. You should consider yourself to have been asked to intervene. But this is another way of kind of making that a little bit more salient for people. And certainly there are some people who are on the chat who are talking about how people have been hurt, how people have been killed, that there are those kinds of horrible stories of people who have chosen to intervene and been hurt themselves, and we certainly don't want to increase those kinds of stories. And so we want to constantly be having people think about what is their safety. And one of the things that our research finds is that a lot of times people will go for they think they have to be the hero on the white horse, and that's the only thing that comes to mind. And so we work really hard to try to help people see that there can be less running into the middle of something, which may actually be able to help someone, which may be able to keep them safer. Obviously, that may not work in all situations, but the other thing is also trying to have that community safety net for bystanders so that if they're trying to do something, they're not then getting penalized by the rest of the community for trying to do something, but are instead being supported and helped in that. So that's kind of our bystander pledge, and then the next slide is sort of the last piece of the project, which is asking people to develop and practice very specific skills. Our program builds on important work that Jeff O'Brien is going to talk about, that MVP and many other programs do with giving people practice with scenarios. Karen, the publication that NSBRC has, I think has some of those. She mentioned has some scenarios to practice in there. But we also ask people to develop their own personal scenario so that we know that everyone inhabits different sub-communities. In our campus, there are some people who don't go to the fraternity party scene while other people do. And so they need to think about where are you most likely to find yourself as a bystander and think through what that situation might look like and what the different options are for what you can do. And this personal plan is kind of modeled on some of the work that Jackson Katz and Jeff O'Brien and others are doing with using those scenarios to get people to think through and practice those skills. So sorry, that was like a lot of lecture talking at you just to kind of give you the view of our program.
All right, so there's been a fabulous discussion about looking at some of the questions around pledge and thinking about strategies, particularly along throughout ages. We'll get to that later. So one of the discussions that people talked about is that it's not just about individuals, but it's also about how do we shift some of the social norms and how do we change the community dynamics. And that's what's, I think, exciting, what's going on in University of New Hampshire, is that you're not just working on the individual skills, but also working on a social marketing campaign.
Right. And my colleague Sharon Potter and Mary Moynihan and some others have really been working over the last 5 or 6 years on this and doing some research on it as well. And you can see the website here. This is another one of the posters that where there's a sort of a physical violence. You'll notice that the posters are UNH students, and unfortunately, for better or worse, they look like UNH. So one of the comments we get pretty regularly about the social marketing campaign is these are not the faces and images that would work for any campus or community, and we, of course, totally understand that. But we are unfortunately not a very diverse campus, but we have tried to work. My colleagues have worked with focus groups of students and students who volunteered to be photographs for these different posters. There are 4 in this series, and my colleagues have just developed another set of 4. for, including one poster related to same-sex couple violence, and those will be coming out later this fall. So stay tuned to that website because that has a lot of information about what they're doing. And it's been a great conversation piece. They've had the posters on campus already, and one of the things that we're hoping to do now that we've gotten this federal grant is to actually be able to wrap a lot of our campus buses with these posters. So people at UNH are going to, I think, hopefully be getting the message over the next couple of years. We'll see. Stay tuned.
Right. And then some of the early, he's jumping the gun a little bit, but some of the early evaluation of this has been showing some shifts around knowledge and some behavioral intention, I believe, right?
Yes, my colleague.
Social marketing.
Yes, have been doing surveys of the community and shown changes in attitudes and confidence and those kinds of things, awareness, those sorts of things as a result of exposure, which is really neat. So. Running out of time. So.
Right, we're going to, and here's just some more. Not only are they posters, but now the ubiquitous water bottle and keychain and other materials.
Yeah, and one of the other things my colleagues have developed is a jump drive that you can give out to students, and when they put it in, before they can download their files onto it, they get a little video prevention message that comes up on their computer screen. So they're doing some kind of market research with that. I'll just conclude by saying, again, I think the real contribution of our work here, in addition to my colleagues' work on the social marketing campaign, is really our evaluation studies. I'm a faculty member, so I'm primarily a research geek in my life, I'm sad to say, but true. So really where I get excited about all this stuff is trying to do some research on this. And we've done focus groups. We've done an experimental design with 400 general college students. We've done pre- and post-surveys with student leader groups, with athletes, with first-year students, all of which show significant changes, not only on attitudes, but particularly the large experiment that we did showed shifts in actual behavior over time, with participants more likely to say they'd actually engaged in particular bystander behaviors over a two-month period. And again, we're going to be doing more of that. And then the social marketing campaign has also had some good success. We've also started looking at some of what some people have talked about in terms of backlash effects, which is looking at, do any participants get worse as a result of being in our program? And we're just starting to do some of those analyses. And the good news is that particularly for the longer program, we see very little of that. Almost none of it for the long program, a little bit more mixed when you only have about 90 minutes with people. But we find that really encouraging as well for a bystander approach.
And several people are asking, can they get the research? And if you go to preventconnect.org, we do list some of the most recent studies. And if you are unable to get your academic journal copies, we have information on how to contact the National Sexual Violence Resource Center and request copies. So there are articles, and there are several articles that have been accepted and have not been published yet, but they will be soon in Prevent Connect listserv. We will certainly be letting people know. So I'm going to certainly you saw a lot of changes, and these changes last over time, and they work for both men and women. I'm running through this because we can move on. And also you've been looking at survivors, and that we've been working on changing attitudes, and that's really promising. What I'd like to do is be able to highlight another program, and we'll come back to questions and answers, and Vicki can be able to join in then. So thank you, Vicki, very much for sharing about bringing in the bystander. And so, and yes, the results will be available on Prevent Connect as we get them. So I do talk to people. These are really exciting pieces. So I'd like to move over to Jeff O'Brien from MVP. He's the National Director for Mentors in Violence Prevention. And welcome today. I'm really glad that you're able to join us, Jeff.
Thanks, David, and hello to everybody. I'd like to say the same, and it certainly is a pleasure to be here and participate in this discussion with everybody. I have seen some familiar names on the scroll, so hello to all of you that I know. I haven't seen many of you personally in a while, so look forward to chatting. Just getting started, for those who are not familiar with MVP, I want to make sure everybody's aware of what it is. MVP at its core, it's a leadership program that focuses on preventing men's violence against women in all of its forms. So we like to make sure that we focus on the leadership concept in all the things that we do, and I'll talk more about that as we get into this. As we look at some of the history, I want to give a little bit of background. The program was created in 1993 by Jackson Katz. Some of you may know Jackson. Jackson was a graduate student at Harvard University in the grad school of education with a researcher by the name of Dr. Ronald Slaby. And he was taking a course that was called a Violence in America course. And some of the early research that Slaby was doing looked at aggressors, victims, and bystanders in violent situations. And Jackson was really enamored by this philosophy and approach and talked a lot with Dr. Slaby early on about it, and then took that idea and concept to Northeastern University in an organization called the Center for the Study of Sport and Society, and with this idea of utilizing this type of a concept specifically geared towards bystanders to try and prevent men's violence against women in all of its forms. So that was the initial genesis of the program, if you will. And I think it's always interesting from the very beginning and still to this day, you know, people, when they hear that we have athletes as trainers, as, you know, deliverers of the messages, and we work a lot with athletic populations, you know, people kind of look at us a little funny. So I wanted to just pose the question to the group, and some of you may know this answer, but, you know, if you could just on the chat line, why do you think it was that when we first started the program, the initial training focus was training male college student athletes? What do you think was going on there? I'll give you a second to respond.
I see things like generally considered leaders, recognized leaders, potential leaders. Male athletes have power. That's an interesting one. Once again, leaders, mentors for men on how should be, in quotes. Entitlement and aggression, that's an interesting comment. They're gods, is an interesting comment. Sports draws men.
So there's a series of responses. And for us, the main thing was that in our culture, I mean, we place a disproportionate emphasis and value on athletics, and in our view, in a fairly negative way. But what we feel we can do is try to use that evil power for good, if you will. And we also recognize that, given the social status that they were afforded, male college student athletes, if we could train them, you know, properly train them, that they could help reframe some of the mainstream understandings of masculinity for younger boys. So the goal was training these male college student athletes to then go work with high school boys and talk with them about what it means to be a man, their relationships with other people, not just with women, just with other people in general, and how they could reframe that in a more positive and healthy construct as opposed to some of the more damaging ones that we see in the mainstream. So it was really their role model status that was the influence for us. The other thing that you see on here is, you know, very quickly we realized that if we're really going to deal with this problem, we can't just have one segment of one population working on it. So in 1995, a female component to the program was added, and that was the beginning of men and women within MVP working together on this issue. So, you know, for us, we initially trained former female athletes now working with younger women. And as we've grown since that time, now we have a wide variety of both folks who are trainers and folks who are being trained in both single and mixed gender formats. We'll talk a little bit more about that. I just wanted to make sure we gave a little bit of background as we jump into this. So I wanted to include a picture of our training group for this year. These are our national trainers, and I always think about, once again, with the whole athlete connection and why we focus on athletes. One is because of this disproportionate focus that we have, but two is also because our organization believes that sport can really be a vehicle with unique power to create social change. So if you understand there's power with something in a culture, how can you use it to benefit other people? So what we try to do is have a diverse group of men and women training with folks all across the country. So that just gives you an idea of some of our smiling faces for the year. And if you look at who are some of the folks that we work with over the course of a year, over a course of a given year, the reason I wanted to include this is just to show some of the scope of what we do. Given Jackson's work, a lot of times folks will assume that we work only with men, or that we only work with military, or only work with sport organizations, and we do quite a bit of work with all of those groups. So I just want to make sure people are aware how we've tried to apply this bystander approach and how it's really worked across these populations. So some of them, you know, as you'll see in here, it's both men and women, girls and boys, and certainly is within college and professional sports. You know, over the years, we've worked with over 150 campuses and athletic departments, worked with over 125 high schools around the country, and delivered over 85 train-the-trainer programs. As we think about some of the different groups we work with, we want to make sure people are aware of that. And that one of the things we really enjoy is doing those train-the-trainer programs with adults, because then, obviously, you can maximize your impact as you try and spread the messages within a given community.
Oh, absolutely. Training the trainers is the way that we can move forward. So can you describe, Jeff, a little bit about how you do your – you talk about who you work with. Can you talk about how you do the work?
Yeah, absolutely. So if you look at the main goals of the program, and as we talked about, you know, I mentioned train the trainers, and we have two main training formats. One type of training is just a general awareness-raising training. Another type of training is a train the trainers, a more extensive program, as you could imagine. And a lot of it depends on the group you're working with. You know, we work with professional sports. As you could probably imagine, they're not going to give us 3 days to do a train the trainers. They'll give us 90 minutes to do some awareness raising and then expect love dust to be sprinkled around the room. But those are basic formats, and as you see on here, these four main goals. You know, the first one, no matter what group we're working with, is we want to raise people's awareness. And one of the things that is important for us is to move beyond the high-profile, more sensationalized cases like a Lacey Peterson case or O.J. Simpson, or the case with the Marine recently here last spring, or with Entwistle up in the Boston area. We want to get beyond those high-profile, sensationalized characteristics and focus on everyday acts, you know, things that are happening to people in their midst, and try to get them to understand that this happens in their midst every day. And then the second thing is to challenge people's thinking. We always like to refer to it as creating healthy tension. We love that whole concept of going in there and challenging people, but doing it in a way that people don't shut down or become defensive. So creating that tension, part of that is our understanding, or at least our belief is that we live in a society now that has underpinnings of racism, sexism, classism, heterosexism, et cetera, and that there are norms that come from those beliefs. So if we think about that, those beliefs, what people might be walking the room with, we need to challenge some of that thinking and challenge those assumptions in a positive way. And we generally do that through opening dialogue, you know, not by telling them they're wrong, but by asking them questions, you know. So it's pretty neat the way that works out. So it's, you know, somebody might say something and and sadly this happens often, that they'll say, well, you know, some women just like to get hit. So we have any number of responses to that, some which could be, you know, attacking right back at them, or others could be, okay, if this is what somebody believes, where did you learn that? Where did that come from? Ask other people. Do people agree? And do other people agree that, you know, some women just like to get hit? And then you can still have a discussion about that, even though somebody makes a very problematic statement, and then you can sum it up at the end. It's tricky, but it certainly, we've found it to be effective. We find that by doing that, you're validating people's thoughts and feelings, and you can respectfully challenge, because the other option would be to attack right at them, tell them how wrong they are, and then you shut that person down who really needs to hear from you the most. So lastly, within this opening dialogue and then transitioning to inspiring leadership, is providing do messages for young people. You know, so often we find when we talk to them that they're confused, and they understand the things that they're not supposed to do, what they tell us is they get a lot of don't messages. Don't do this, don't do that, don't get in trouble, you know, all these other things. But where are the do messages? This is what you should do. Do this, do that, have conversations about do's as opposed to don'ts. And as I mentioned at the beginning, at its core, MVP is about leadership. So for us, it's all about empowering people, motivating them, doing some skill building, which we'll talk about later. And at the end of the day, you know, making sure we're communicating that all of the, what we're talking about with bystanders, these are leadership issues. They are inherently leadership issues. And we'll challenge people, you know, with this healthy tension we talk about by asking them questions like, do you have the courage to do what's right when the time comes? And then just letting them talk about it. Or, you know, if you believe that there is a problem with men's violence against women, why is it that so many people, both men and women, are silent in the face of it? You know, just asking questions like that go to really challenging them but also inspiring, hopefully. And one of the last activities we do in closing a program is we have the folks in a group go around and talk about how they're going to utilize their leadership and the skills they've learned in the training to impact themselves and their peer group walking away. And then quickly, just as you see on the page, the two pictures you see there, the one on the top is one of our adult training groups. This was in Boston as well, where we do an activity that's called Agree, Disagree, Unsure. I'm sure many people do something very similar to this. I just wanted to give you an example of the way we try to open dialogue and then challenge people in a way that doesn't make them defensive. One of the things, by physically moving people around, can really do wonders for the dynamic and energy in a room. So you can ask questions in a standing setting in a room like that sometimes don't go well with a traditional classroom format or even in a large circle. And then in the ground, the bottom photo there, you see three participants from a train-the-trainer program who what they're doing is implementation planning for how they're going to utilize a curriculum in their setting when they leave the training. So I just wanted to point those pictures out to you, what you were looking at. So with that being said, we want to move to the next piece here and talk a little bit about bystanders in general, since you know that's the focus primarily of the call, and try to do something that will add to what's been said earlier without repeating too much. I talked about earlier Dr. Ronald Slaby and his influence on Jackson in the early creation of MVP, basically what Ron Slaby had was this habits of thought model, and I talked about that earlier, that Jackson adapted to what we call an MVP, a train of thought model that speaks specifically to bystanders. And I'll talk about that in a little bit once we get to some of our curriculum. And I know some folks may be wondering about Slaby. Basically what you can do is if people are interested in particular about his research or some of what he's written is Google his name with aggressors, bystanders, and victims, and his Vita will pop up with all of his publications on it. I thought that would be a more effective way for you to see some of that. And you see on here this point about critical mass, and this is important to us as we conceptualize a bystander approach and how we feel bystanders can be proactive. And when you think about critical mass, at least for us, if you take a group of 100 people, let's say, and then you take a cross-section of them and take 10 of them, 10 people out of that group of 100. And our thought when we think about a bystander approach and its success is going to be that in every group, out of those 10, you're going to have two or three folks who, as soon as you walk in the room and say, we need help, we need some people to step up and be proactive bystanders, they're going to say, where do I sign? They're going to be all over it. And then just like you have those two who are all over it, on the opposite end of the spectrum, at least we believe that you're going to have two to three people who, no matter what you say, are not going to do anything. They're just not convinced. Either they don't think it's an issue, they're too self-focused that they're not going to step out there for somebody else. You're just not going to reach them. So we feel those are a given, those two to three on either end of the spectrum. But also, for us, the good news is that leaves four to six people who are on the fence. They're in the middle, and they're trying to figure out what they're going to do. You know, they're more sheep than anything else. They're usually following the popular crowd or following what they think is most normal. And then for us, what we find is if we can somehow challenge, motivate, and inspire that group that's on the fence to get them to come to the good side, if you will, that we can do some, create a paradigm shift that might change some norms around bystander behavior and really get people to think differently about their role. So when we talk about critical mass, that's some of the things we're thinking about. And then, you know, as we've been on the call, we've talked a lot about bystander intervention and the way bystanders can be proactive, but I think it's important to also even think about, okay, do bystanders even really have any power in these situations? So I'd like to give people an opportunity to respond to that in another text chat and just respond to, what do you think? Do you think bystanders have power?
People to write in about do they have power, and I hear absolutely, yes, 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 absolutely again. And lots of yeses and even a C. and I got one that depends on the situation, and yes, especially in numbers. So I think we've got a thing coming here, but a pretty strong consensus.
and as you could probably imagine, depending on the group you work with, you're going to have a wide range of folks who will respond to that question, or they'll respond to it in a wide range of ways. And for us, we always like to make sure as we start talking with a group about their potential as a leader and as an empowered bystander to do something, but first of all, to even think, do they have power? And one of the analogies we always use that we find to be particularly effective in getting people to focus on that visually is a high school fight. So think, if you can, back to high school. I know for some of us that might be further back than others, but, you know, think back to high school and think about two boys squaring off in a high school hallway. You know, what happens around them? You know, as they're squaring off, what happens around them? You know, generally there's this group of people that gathers around. What's the group? What are they yelling? You know, they're yelling fight, 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 and probably some other colorful terms. And if you think about this dynamic, you got this group around the outside, these two boys on the inside, and let's say I'm one of those boys and I don't really want to be there. You know, what realistic social chance do I have of saying, you know what, I have math class coming up here in a couple minutes and I can't be late. Let's pick this up later. You know, is that realistic? You know, that's socially, that's not very realistic because of, we know what's going to happen socially to me if I try to do that. So basically I'm stuck in that situation. And I think about those people on outside. Think about the influence they had on my behavior, on the other person's behavior, and how they really served to escalate that situation. Usually people, that's a good visual for young people in particular to see, oh, wow, yeah, I could see how that would be the case. But then you transition that to a similar situation where one of the friends, let's say my friend, came in and grabbed me and said, hey, Jeff, it's not even worth it, man. It's not even worth it. You're going to get kicked off. You're getting kicked out of school, whatever the case may be. It's not worth it. And he pulls me away. And you think about how likely it would be that might squash that situation, if you will, right on the spot. And now I know, you know, any number of things can happen, but overwhelmingly, if somebody steps in, overwhelmingly, it generally does stop the situation almost instantly. And think about why. You know, think about why. You know, one of the reasons why is because that bystander who intervened took the pressure, the social pressure off the person who was in the situation. Right? So even if I didn't want to be in that situation, now my friend helped me to get out of it. So when we think about those type of dynamics, we want to make sure people are always aware of there's inherent power to either negatively or positively influence these situations, but you have to use your mind. You know, so the whole idea of being Superman or Wonder Woman is not very healthy and certainly not very safe. But if you use thinking options, you can make a difference. So for us, the last piece you see on here is, you know, why would we focus on bystanders? And I think you've heard a lot of that already with some of the theoretical approaches. And I'll just add one little piece to that still. When we look at it from an MVP perspective, there's also the social and philosophical perspective on why. And one of the reasons why is looking at Western philosophical thought, this whole idea and concept of rugged individualism, it really teaches people this whole, you know, pull yourself up by your bootstraps, that type of thing, plays well into somebody taking care of themselves. But how well does that play as it relates to taking care of a community and taking care of other people? And we really look at this notion of rugged individualism as helping socialize our populace into inaction and indifference. And then as a result, what we end up needing is to teach our folks, our people, all of us, skills as a bystander. You know, how do we teach these skills as a bystander? And the last thing I'll say about that is understanding that when we teach those skills, this dynamic is inherently gendered. You know, and how men and women approach this and how men and women are proactive bystanders are different because it's gendered. So, you know, for a man, oftentimes there's this physical aspect to it. There's this violent aspect to it, not as a bystander, but the threat of violence or physical interaction. And I'll talk more about that in a minute. There's obviously tons more to say about these dynamics as we go.
People are having that conversation in the text chat also. So we're
that's not fair. I want to have that conversation too.
Can you talk a little bit about this third party involved, you know, just refer to this third party involvement in violent crime study?
Yeah, so, you know, aside from the social and philosophical pieces of this, you know, I wanted to include this because this is the most recent survey that they've done, and obviously it's not that recent at this point. It was a 2002 special report. But as you look at third parties or what we're considering, bystanders and violent crime in this country, in this six-year period, two-thirds of the time you had a bystander present when a violent crime was committed. And what the victims told officials was that if the bystanders acted, they overwhelmingly helped. Unfortunately, overwhelmingly, they didn't act. So once again, when we talk about why do we need to focus on bystanders, why do we need to teach bystander skills, it's because we don't have them. We're socialized in the other direction overwhelmingly. So, you know, once again, just a quick slide to focus on that.
Talk a little about your educational philosophy. And actually, you've talked a lot about this. The learning pyramid's interesting way to think about it.
So, yeah, I'll be brief this time. As you mentioned, David, I addressed this a little bit already. I feel the learning pyramid is always a good visual explanation of the way we try to approach this. Some of the things that we always like to make sure we're doing is that we're asking instead of telling. So one of our cardinal rules is, as a facilitator, is if you can ask the question to get the information, don't tell the information. So, you know, don't get caught up in hearing yourself speak. Make sure you're asking the question to get somebody else to speak. And when we think about these programs, that it's discussion-based, they're highly interactive, they're focusing on challenging and teaching each other all the way through. And then when you see this learning pyramid visual, basically what we're trying to do is keep ourselves in the bottom half of that pyramid at all times with our educational philosophy. Right, so the whole idea of the learning pyramid is trying to stay in the lower half of that pyramid so we can maximize retention. And then hopefully, if the retention rate is high, participants will actually use the information in their real lives, you know, which would be an amazing concept, you know, actually using the information in their real lives, because that's what we want them to do, not tell us the right answers in the training room, but have an experience that will lead them to use the information when they really need it in a very difficult social situation. Because make no mistake about it, these are difficult situations for people socially.
Now, you focus a lot, Jeff, on leadership, and so let's talk briefly about some of the leadership approach.
Right. Thanks, David. So when we look at leadership and our philosophy, I want to just make a couple points, and I'll be brief with each of these. The first one that we feel is so important is answering the why. And I think to some extent both Karen and Vicki have talked about this in their own way. But we feel we have to help individuals, both females and males, answer the question of why. Why should I act? Why should I care? Why should I be involved? And I know most of you are educators in the call, so it doesn't really surprise you of that they would be so selfish, but that's the world we live in. So part of our job and our challenge, we feel, is to help them answer that question, and we do that in a number of different ways. I mean, one of which is continuing to reframe the discussion, reframing it around leadership, reframing it about responsibility, both personal, professional, university responsibility, and then also to personalize the issues as much as we can. The next one is creating a safe space. If they don't feel comfortable to have the conversation, they're not going to engage us in any other type of learning. So for us, there's no discussion about who's a perpetrator and who's a victim or survivor. It's really focused on creating this healthy tension that is safe, that will allow them to talk. And then, as I mentioned earlier, we have a mix of mixed and single gender formats to allow that to happen. And then humor. I mean, I may not be the funniest of our trainers, but geez, you have to be able to intersperse some appropriate humor into the situation. Now, some people may say, what on earth could be funny about any of this? It's not that the topics are funny. It's a matter of just trying to insert appropriate humor at different times to make sure you're maximizing learning. So that it goes into that the whole idea of creating safe space. And then, especially with men's group, just ensuring that any humor does not cross the line into colluding or minimizing the behavior. Which, you know, we just try to work really hard to make sure that doesn't happen. And what we always refer to as remedial empathy education, just on a very basic level, get an idea of, or get people to understand that you need to care about other people as well. And part of this remedial empathy is caring about other people, but also how do these issues inherently impact you? You know, if you're a woman or a man living in this culture, doesn't matter if it's happening to you, these issues are impacting you in one way or another, and trying to find our best strategies to get to that. And then we try to, as trainers, try to role model healthy behaviors and healthy approaches the best we can. And then the skill building we'll talk about as we move forward.
Right, and once again, as usual, time flies by, but you do have some of your tools in your playbooks, and we do have a link to getting information about the you can get more information from MVP at the link on the website.
Great. So the next slide you see is just a copy of one of our playbooks. Our playbooks, they're our key teaching tool, and within our playbooks, and just to take a step back, if you're wondering why we use the term playbook, it goes back to our origins in the sports culture and uses a lot of sports analogies to communicate very common messages in the violence against women field. What we try to use these playbook scenario discussions for is to create context for the discussions. And I'll talk in a minute about what I mean by that. But another part of answering the why for our groups is if you don't provide the appropriate context, they're not going to understand why they should get involved. And within these playbooks, we have versions, as you can see in the bullet here, for all the groups we work with. So everybody that I mentioned, both adult educators, I mean adult groups in general, military groups, athletic groups, high school groups, middle school groups, we have curriculum and playbooks for each of those populations as we work with, and then scenarios that are relative to them. And then in each of them, as I mentioned, there was a series of social scenarios that depict all the participants as bystanders witnessing their peers either about something's about to happen, something has happened in some way, shape, or form, because, you know, the bystander spectrum goes before there's violence or abuse up to all during the abuse to after. And what we try to do is talk to them about that whole range. You know, how can you identify something before it happens type of thing? So we'll talk to you a little bit more on this next slide about that. What we put in here was an example of one, and on my screen it looks a little blurry, so it probably is on yours too. But it's basically, this is a scenario from our male college student-athlete playbook, and it's a scenario that deals with the issue of battering in an abusive relationship. So when I talked about providing context, so the way this would generally work is we'd have them read the scenario, and we always ask them to do it. So we ask somebody, can somebody read the scenario? They would read it. somebody else read the train of thought. This train of thought, this is the piece that Jackson adapted from Dr. Slaby's Habits of Thought model, and where the Habits of Thought model from Slaby spoke to the mental processes of aggressors, victims, and bystanders, our train of thought focuses specifically on the bystander. So for all the participants in the room, it's them. This is what's going through their mind. And we ask them if it's realistic. And then we use this as a springboard to talk about the dynamics of battering in this case. So we be able to talk about power and control, about manipulation, have a brainstorming, informative discussion around, for the men who hit women, why do they do it? And then we also have a discussion for women who would stay in a relationship, why would they stay? And a lot of times people would say, geez, you know, doesn't that borderline on victim blaming? Why would you go down that road? Well, what we want to do is prepare these folks as bystanders for all the number of things that could happen. And one thing that we hear quite often is that a young person will intervene at a party on a Friday night, maybe when they see this happening. And then on Monday, they see that couple together again. And then they become very confused as a bystander and feel like, well, that was pointless. Why did I put myself on the line if, quote unquote, she was just going to go back to him? So it gives us an opportunity to talk about some of the dynamics that are inherent in abusive relationships, so they have a broader understanding, and then hopefully being able to be a more informed bystander and understand. And the other thing we really get to talk about is violence and abuse as a choice within this dynamic. So just to give you an idea, that's the context building. And then what we try to do is transfer after the context building into a discussion on what could they do in this situation. And, you know, some of the questions we like to ask, because we know people are thinking them, is, okay, in a situation like this, why would somebody not intervene here? What might be barriers that would prevent somebody from doing something like this? You know, so it, you know, gives them opportunities to even talk about what are some of the challenges. We get to talk about the status impact of bystanders. You know, so since this is college student athletes, if I'm a first year student athlete and this is a senior who's my teammate doing this, you know, what's the likelihood that I'm going to feel confident to step up directly to him? So given that, what other options are available to me? You know, like having discussions around that type of thing.
We're running out of time, and I do want to be able to give, if people have any chance for questions, to be able to do that.
Sure.
Have done some of the evaluation, and we do have links to those evaluation. You've done it both in high school and also with college-age male and female student-athletes. And what it has shown is that both an increase in some of the knowledge, in positive knowledge, and increasing knowledge and attitudes and behaviors, and also really strengthening self-efficacy to take bystander action. So that's really exciting to see that. So if people have, and I'll give Jeff a chance to comment, but if anyone has a question, go ahead and raise your hand. I see that we have one person that's raised their hand, Kathleen Hodge. So, operator, if you could open up Kathleen Hodge's phone, and she can be able to pose her question. If anyone else has a question, you can raise your hand or put it into the text chat and for our panelists to answer. And, Jeff, do you want to say anything last about the evaluation other than my quick summary?
No, I thought that was fine. That was good. Thank you, David.
So is Kathleen's phone off? Opened?
Yes, Kathleen's line is now open.
Hi, Kathleen. Are you there, Kathleen?
Yes, I'm here.
And do you have a question?
Hello? Yes, I'm here, but my question actually was answered just a couple of minutes ago, so thank you very much.
Oh, well, how's that for efficient? Okay, how about Stephen Montagna? Stephen, I will pronounce your last name. Stephen Montagna.
Good enough. Montagna.
Okay, thank you, Steve.
Thank you. Yes, I'm with Men Stopping Rape out in Madison, Wisconsin. And first of all, thank you so much for putting this program together. I just wanted to get a little more regarding MVP and programming, whether or not you do or not with coaches. One of my trouble spots when dealing with athletic populations is that particularly with athletes and also with the military, these are two areas which are so steeped in a tradition of using misogyny to motivate men. And these are environments where you have to motivate men. You have to motivate them to run faster, You have to motivate them to become part of a cohesive military unit. But they are so steeped in that sort of process that it's not even a question for these guys of being bystanders. They are really principally entangled in misogyny and in violence against women effectively as victims on a certain level. And it sounds like some of your programming does touch upon trying to get these guys to get in touch with that. How has this affected me? But I wonder what you're doing from the sort of top down, if you will, programming with the coaches who are going to be on the fields with these guys. And when they need to motivate a player, what's a different way of going about it besides putting him down and disrespecting and basically, you know, using language that's misogynist and re-imprints the sense that women are less than men?
Jeff, do you want to address that briefly?
Yeah, absolutely.
And operator, if you can open up Maria Ward's line while he is responding.
It's a great question, Stephen. Thanks for that, too. One of the things we've been able to do is every time we go to work with an athletic department at a school, their general interest is us working with the student athletes, but we insist on a training session for coaches and the senior administrative staff as well.
Excellent.
Because, and once again, you know, with the love dust analogy again, we don't kid ourselves that having one 90-minute, you know, training with the coaches that they're cured from all the things you talked about.
Mm-hmm.
But we challenge them in a very fun way, let me say. But we have the opportunity to make sure they understand what they should be doing as leaders as well.
Yep. You also, there's Terry O'Brien's asked several times, do you have any version of MVP for adults in the community?
Yes, we do.
Okay, great. And Maria, are you...
Maria's actually not online yet. Maria, can you please press *0 so I can locate your line?
So, we are running out of time and...
Okay, here we go. Okay, one second.
Welcome, Maria.
Maria is now live in conference.
Hi, David. How are you?
I'm doing fine. We have just a couple minutes.
Yeah, sure. I would like to know if you go outside of CAICASA to other jurisdictions to train people or train the trainers on MVP.
Well, it's not CAICASA that does MVP. That's Mentors and that's Jeff O'Brien with Mentors in Violence Prevention. Jeff, do you go outside of the 50 states?
Yes.
Okay, thank you very much.
Okay, great. So what I'd like to do is thank everyone today. I'd like to thank Jeff and Vicki and Karen for joining us today. We have a lot of resources. There's a lot of discussion, excellent discussion in our text chat. I know a lot of discussion about Dorothy Edwards. We're actually going to be interviewing her for a Prevention Connection podcast shortly. And so want to be able to highlight getting that information. I am going to put up an evaluation. We will also send you an email with the evaluation. So you can either do the evaluation, wrong piece. So we will put the evaluation up so you can be able to fill out our evaluation. I do encourage you to join us in the future at a Prevention Connection web conference so that you should see on your screen. You will also get this email link. Once when we conclude the web conference. So thank you, Karen and Vicki and Jeff, and thank all of you for participating. We will have a copy of the slides and all the materials available on our web conference. So I appreciate it. So any last comments anyone wants to make?
Oh, this is Karen. I think the NSBRC has a whole section on bystander resources as well at www.nsbrc.org.
Great. Well, we will do it. And, yes, the text chat will be available. We will make a copy for everyone so you can be able to get a copy. There was some excellent sharing of resources. So thank you. I always have tremendous respect for the Prevention Connection audience, for the thoughtfulness in the work you do. And we look forward to hearing from all of you as we are working to prevent violence against women. So thanks to all the speakers and thanks to all of the presenters. Speakers, please stay on the line. The rest of you, this will conclude your audio portion of the web conference. Thank you very much.